You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Pop a top again. I've just got time for one more round. Set them up, my friend. Then I'll be gone and you can let some other fool sit.
7:32 on the west coast of America. That's right. We continue. And as I said, fired up this morning to have a former Marine make a national news. And Nielsen sends me this message, says, "Hey, McNamara, you got to have my guy Rob on your show." I'm like, "Okay, no problem. Who is the dude?" He says, "Well, you know the dude that's doing all the marathons?" I said, "Yeah, that guy's crazy." And Nielsen says, "Yeah, he is, but you need to have him on." So joining us is that crazy Marine, Rob Jones. So, Rob, first of all, good morning and welcome to All Marine Radio.
Morning. Thanks, man. It's an honor to be here, be on the show.
Well, but look, you're like, you're a national celebrity now, so congratulations on that, man. You're like Kim Kardashian.
I think my 15 minutes are in about 14:59 right now.
I don't know about that. The first of all, we need to learn about you to find out if you're legit or just one of the, you know, just a typical Marine full of shit or what. So what? Born and raised where?
Loudoun County, Virginia. Well, born in Maryland, raised in Loudoun County, Virginia.
All right. So you're a northern
the northern part of the state.
Northern Virginia, yeah. Kind of guy. The how's the Marine Corps get on your radar?
I was in Virginia Tech my junior year, and I had a couple buddies that joined, and I was just at a point where I was looking for something else as well, and so that's how it got on my radar, and then I researched it and decided to join up.
So you were a junior at Virginia Tech when you enlisted?
Yeah. My intention was to finish my last year and then use the time in the reserves as a little bit to add to my application to be an officer. But once I finished at Virginia Tech, my reserve unit was sending a volunteer platoon to Iraq, so I opted to do that instead.
Okay, so you go through boot camp when? What year?
2006, during the summertime. It's the 92-day reserve program. So I went did boot camp during summer break. And then I'd finished my last year, and I went and did MCT in Combat Engineer School next summer in 2007.
So you're a combat engineer by trade?
Yeah, that was my MOS.
All right, and so your reserve unit, what reserve unit were you with?
I was in Bravo Company, 4th Combat Engineer Battalion, out of Roanoke, Virginia.
Hua. The does Bravo Company have a motto? Come on.
Not that I know. to be honest with you,
come on.
Yeah, I don't know what that would be.
They don't have some kind of like smash it and burn it kind of Bravo Company smash it and burn it. They don't have anything like that.
Not that I'm aware of. Right. That's actually a good question. I don't even know what 4th Combat Engineer Battalions would be.
That's a
good question.
It's all right. I'm a grunt, so nobody. I mean, come on. Who cares? Like, come on. It's engineer stuff. What kind of debt did got put together that you were assigned to when you went to Afghanistan?
What kind of
detachment got put together that you were a part of that got you to Afghanistan?
So the way it worked was the Iraq deployment, they sent, the way that it works with CEB battalions is we attach one platoon to a battalion of infantry.
Okay.
And so for that first deployment in 2008 to Iraq, we had one platoon that was attached to 224, which is another reserve infantry unit.
You bet.
And the way it would work would be one squad would go with a company, and then each platoon in that company would have one team.
Got it.
associated with it. So my team, or my squad, was attached to Fox Company 224 in Iraq, and my squad in Afghanistan was attached to Kilo 37.
Okay, so you went to Iraq first?
Yeah, I went to Iraq in 2008 on that volunteer platoon.
Oh, okay.
And then came back, and my reserve unit was sending pretty much another, immediately sending another volunteer platoon to Afghanistan. Just a little over a year in between those deployments.
Right. So give me a lesson learned out of the first deployment. And
first
where was 224? Where were you working?
We were in Hamdiya.
Okay. Right.
Which is in the general vicinity of Fallujah.
Right, between Fallujah and Ramadi. Fallujah and Ramadi on Route Michigan, right?
Yep, right on Route Michigan there next to TQ.
Right.
Is the big base.
Right. And so what were you guys... We were
on Camp Hamdiya.
Well, there you go. What were you guys doing? So you guys were supporting Grunt. So what, on a typical day, they're going out, they're patrolling, you know, they're clearing roads, you know, and doing escort stuff or whatever. What are you doing to support that?
Well, as you know, in 2008, things in Hamdiya had died down. There wasn't a lot of enemy action going on. So the primary role that I was playing was cache sweeping. So
okay.
The infantry guys would get a tip from a local or just some other kind of tip that there might be a buried weapons cache in the town somewhere, and we would patrol over there, and me and one other engineer would go out and we'd try and find it. And so we would sweep with our metal detectors an entire vacant lot or somebody's backyard or just the side of a road or something like that. And then we'd sweep until we decided, you know, either the cache that was there is too well hidden for us to find, or there wasn't anything there, or we found something. So we'd find stuff like RPGs and stuff that had just been there for a while, buried in the ground.
Did you guys find the big bugaboo? And I read a couple stories that about Army engineers finding chemical weapons and didn't realize it till after they began to handle them they were chemical weapons. You find anything of interest while you guys were poking around?
We did. We did find... I can't remember. It was one of the biggest weapons caches in Al Anbar.
Really?
That had ever been found. It was pretty big, man. Like, the crater after we blew it up was like, I don't know, 20 to 30 meters across. It was big.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, so it was pretty big boom, and it was a giant-ass cache. And so that would really be the only thing. We didn't really find any kind of special stuff, just, you know, regular munitions.
Right. Right, right. So you come back home. So give me a lesson learned from that. So that your first really taste of combat, and you know, we can say that it wasn't very kinetic at the time, but you know, still there's every time you go out, you know, there's IEDs still out there that are in the ground, that on occasion, you know, would detonate, and it's still not a safe place to be. Give me a lesson learned from your first deployment.
Yeah, it was just about getting experience on deployment. Like you said, it was really there. I never had any. I didn't even get a combat action ribbon that time, and we had. Sadly, we did have one IED strike on a couple guys that did get killed. But really, besides that was it. No combat at all, and. Yeah, it was just getting experience, getting to be in Iraq, getting that firsthand, you know, patrolling in an actual war environment, and using my combat engineer skills in an actual, you know, on a deployment. So that's pretty much what we did. And I also learned that I did not like the new flak vest they came out with in 2008.
All right, so now you come back home and you're hating on the flak vest, and
it was this big heavy thing,
right?
Like a piece of full suit of armor. And then Afghanistan, we used the plate carriers. And I was like,
thank God.
It's 180 degrees.
Right. Thank God somebody used their brain. So so talk about the decision to go to Afghanistan. What was that based on? And because I'm sure there's people in your family that said, why are you volunteering for this stuff?
Well, I joined the Marine Corps to fight, you know, America's enemies. And so that's why, I mean, I would have, even if I hadn't, I wasn't quite satisfied with the experience in Iraq because I didn't get to, you know, participate in war like I had intended to. But even if I had, I still would have volunteered again. You know, it's just because that was my job that I had envisioned. That I in the Marine Corps to fight the battles of the Marine Corps. So I had another chance to do it. And so I jumped on the chance.
All right, so
if I hadn't have done that, I probably would have gone active duty at that point or, didn't try it out for MARSOC or something like that.
All right. So at that point, you're what rank on your way to Afghanistan?
Corporal is when I got to Afghanistan.
Corporal Jones. All right.
Leader.
All right. Now, who do you support in Helmand?
On that deployment, we were, my platoon was attached to 3-7, and my squad was attached to Kilo Company, and I was spent most of my time with 3rd platoon.
Okay, so 3-7 is up in Sangin, they get relieved by 3-5. What month are you there? What month do you go?
We got there in April, and we spent the first little bit of that in Delaram, which is in Farah province. I forget the name of the province that we were in initially.
Right.
It was right on the border of Helmand and something else. But then in July, we moved to Helmand and we did a push into Musa Kala. And then we came back and then we kind of reestablished. We took over from the Brits in Sangin.
Okay, so let me ask you a technical question that gets argued about by Marines. Musa Kala or Musa Kala? Which is it?
I've heard it both ways, man. I have no idea.
All right. Who's the hillbilly?
I say Musa Kala.
Okay. All right.
I don't know. I say Musa Kala. I've seen it spelled three different ways, so I really have no idea. I wouldn't. I'd accept both.
Got it. So you're a team leader. Talk to us about the experience up in Sangin with 3-7 when you get up there in the vicinity of Musa Kala. What are you guys doing? It's a pretty it's a pretty busy place, much different than Iraq, I would think. Talk about your experience there as a team leader now.
So going into Musa Kala, it was pretty much we just pushed. I mean, we got helicoptered in to this one spot. And then we just started walking into Taliban territory and taking over compounds and then waiting for follow-on forces that would kind of secure them, and then we would keep moving. We just did that for about 2 weeks. And then I think we, for whatever reason, we ended up just walking back. So I don't really know exactly what the overall mission of that was. But we just kind of took some Taliban territory and then moved back, and then we moved to Sangin. So it was pretty much the same exact thing where we started at FOB Inkerman and we pushed into Taliban territory and just started taking over compounds and just taking Taliban ground. And they would try and stop us. They'd shoot at us a little bit, plant their IEDs, but we just kept moving.
Okay, so give everybody, because everybody's read a whole lot, 3-5 after 3-7. Had a tough time for the first 90 days of their deployment. Give us a normal day for you guys as engineers in support of grunts in Sangin. A lot of people have heard a lot about it, so you were doing it. So what was it like?
So when we were doing a push, what we would do is launch line charges through IED belts. So we went from FOB Inkerman. So we launched a line charge from a Miklik trailer, and that's like 90 meters long of C4.
Mm-hmm.
So we cleared out a nice little path, and then we walked along that path, and we'd take over a compound. And then we established a few compounds, and then for the next little bit, we would just kind of send out security patrols, as you would just from any other FOB. And so I would just go along with the grunts and whatever they needed me to do. So we would get up to a place where there might be an IED, so I would go out there and check it out. So, for example, if we were going to cross a bridge, I would go check out the bridge and make sure there weren't any IEDs, and then leave a little trail for everybody else to follow. And then if we were going to do like a hit on a compound or take over a compound, I would go in there and clear the compound before anybody went in. And then they would go in and do whatever they had to do, and then we'd leave.
Okay. Give everybody a sense of the IEDs you guys would run into. What did they consist of? Very, very different, my experience anyway. In Iraq, the majority of them were 122 shells, 120, 152 shells, you know, wired a lot of times with a cell phone, sometime command detonated, but most of the time wired electronically with some kind of, not victim operated, but some kind of, bad guy initiated device up in Iraq. In Afghanistan, very different. You know, most of it, a lot of them, homemade explosives, with pressure plates, some command detonated stuff. What would be typical of where you were working in terms of IEDs?
Yeah, you said it, man. Pressure plates that were, you know, they didn't have any excess munitions really in Afghanistan.
Right.
So they just made a bunch of homemade explosives, like you said, and they would wire it up to a battery, 9-volt battery, and wire that up to a really, really low metal pressure plate that have about, you know, a strand of copper wire in there from the top and bottom of the pressure plate, and that'd be about it as far as metal. They'd put it in shampoo bottles or between two pieces of wood or what have you. And they would bury it in the ground. And that area, a lot of the stuff was old stuff because we had just taken over from the Brits, and the Brits were not really doing a whole lot of patrolling. And so I imagine most of the stuff that was there was old, and put us at an even bigger disadvantage because we weren't really able to discern the kind of newness of something being buried.
Right.
When something's buried, you know, recently, you'll be able to kind of tell a little bit. But since these ones had been there so long, you know, the ground pretty much had time to recreate itself and look pretty much normal. And so, you know, they put them in just in the ground. They like to put them in compound walls. They put it in the wall there and wire the pressure plate to the ground. They would put them in doorways. Pretty much any kind of choke point that you could think of, there's possibility for an IED to be in there.
And I want you to, if you don't mind, my guest is Rob Jones here on All Marine Radio. See, isn't All Marine Radio cool? You don't talk about this stuff with like a newspaper guy, man. They don't even know.
Not really in this kind of detail.
No, but you know, it's our tribe, man. We all get it. Well, explain to people, when you talk about, you know, the initiating device, if you will, a lot of times just two strands of copper wire. You're out there with a compact metal detector, but they're pretty efficient in terms of low metal signature when they used that stuff, yes?
You mean the metal detectors or the pressure plates?
The pressure plates.
Yeah, they knew. I mean, they know. They watch us and they see what we're doing. And they figured out, you know, that's why they stopped using the radio-controlled IEDs, because they saw that we had jammers.
Right.
So it kind of went pressure plates, and then they moved to radio control, and then we counteracted that, and they moved back to pressure plates. And so, yeah, it would literally just be a shampoo bottle, and then they would take a single strand of copper wire and kind of weave that around the top, and then they would do the same thing on the bottom. And that's all the metal that was in it, unless you could find the battery. But they would usually offset the battery a ways away from the pressure plate itself. So if you approach from the correct direction, then you might find the battery first, and then you'd know. But if you approach from the wrong direction, you're not going to find the battery before you find the pressure plate. And I don't want to say it's hit or miss whether you find the pressure plate, because, you know, there's a lot of guys that were able to find them.
Right.
But if you don't have your sensitivity set just right on your metal detector, you know, it could be, it's going to be pretty tough. And if you don't have any other indicators, like I said, the area out there was pretty much baked, and you couldn't really tell. So if you don't have any other indicators, it's going to be a lot more difficult.
So just sort of trying to paint a picture of what engineers do on a daily basis, and you go out there and you do that at that period of time, you do that just about every day that Marines go out, and you know, engineers, huge contribution to keeping people alive. Talk about now, you're still a corporal at this time?
Yeah, I was a corporal the entire time in Afghanistan.
All right, so talk about how'd you get wounded?
So we were doing one of those pushes that I was telling you about. This is the second push, so we pushed once, and then we established a stronghold and then hit some security patrols for a little while, and they were doing another push. So I was with a squad that was providing security for a vehicle column that had the MICLIC in it, and Liz just had all of our vehicles. And so we were just providing security for that column. And at one point during the day, we laid down to take a break. We stepped off, and the point man stepped on an IED. And, you know, luckily for everybody, there were no injuries because, like I said, these things were old.
Right.
So his blasting, or his IED malfunctioned, and the blasting cap didn't set off the main charge like it's supposed to.
Right.
And so all that happened was the blasting cap went off. So I don't know whether it was just not made correctly, or if maybe the elements got into the mixture and made it inert. I don't know what happened with it, but didn't go off correctly. But now that becomes an area that has a pretty much guaranteed likelihood of having another IED, because, you know, they like to put secondaries, tertiaries in there. And so I stepped up in order to do my thing and try and guide us through the area, and I was trying to do that and missed it, stepped on pressure plate, or maybe it was a radio control. I don't really know exactly what type of IED it was. Probably a pressure plate. But, I got hit by an IED that worked still, and that resulted in double above knee amputations.
Do you remember? Were you knocked out? Do you remember it? You know, it's interesting, Rob. Have you met Charlie Linville?
I don't think so.
He's the Marine Staff Sergeant, EOD, wounded after you were up in Sangin. He was supporting 3-5, but he went to the top of Mount Everest. He's that guy.
I don't think I've met him.
You will.
I know who he is. I haven't met him, though.
Right. At some point, you guys will cross paths because you guys have very similar stories. He was not knocked unconscious when he stepped on his. Tell us about what you remember when you stepped on that pressure plate or when that IED functioned.
Yeah, I was unconscious for 20 seconds, I would say, probably. And then I woke up, and then, you know, it's pretty much like you would expect. Like you see in the movies, basically, with the guys screaming and bleeding, and then everybody rushes over and puts the tourniquets on and calls in the helicopter. Corman comes over and gave me some morphine. You know, and they're telling me, you know, you're going to live, and I was asking questions, like I wanted to know, you know, what was the status of certain body parts, and, you know, they would tell me, and then eventually they loaded me onto the stretcher and carried me over to a tank, or the assault breacher vehicle, actually.
Okay.
And they loaded me up in there, and the corpsman gave me another shot, and that made me unconscious for good. And then from what I understand, the ABV met the CASVAC helicopter wherever they had set that up.
When was the next time you woke up?
I woke up in Germany for about 10 minutes or something. You're not actually supposed to wake up in Germany.
Right.
They try and keep you sedated pretty much until you get back to Bethesda. But I woke up in Germany for about 10 minutes. And don't really remember much. I was pretty high on all the painkillers and stuff. I just remember that I woke up, and then next time I woke up after that was actually when I got to Bethesda, I think, is my next memory. I have a vague memory of being transported on an aircraft or an Air Force transport, but I don't know when and where I was at the time. But the next time I really have clear memories is when I got to Bethesda Naval Hospital and they rolled me out of the transport that they used, this big, pretty much semi tractor trailer hospital ambulance.
A semi tractor trailer. So this thing, what pulls up on
it's
the?
It's not quite that big.
But it's pretty big.
It's not quite as big as it's this giant ass, really giant ambulance. It's probably three times the size. It's probably three times as long as a regular ambulance, maybe one and a half to two times as tall.
Wow.
So it's pretty big.
No,
and they have a bunch of people in there.
As I said, this is All Marine Radio, so when you say giant ass ambulance, we get it, okay?
that's
a technical term. That's a technical term for us. Talk to us about that point, because, you know, so much of what we've learned, you know, from different guys is that have come on All Marine Radio and talked about, you know, and All Marine Radio is about post-combat related mental health. We don't tell everybody that, but what we do is we tell compelling stories, right? We talk about our culture, we talk about the Navy and their leadership struggles. So we talk about our culture, and then when they're not paying attention, we say, don't kill yourself, okay? You can do it, right? We owe that to our friends who didn't come home to live better lives.
Yeah.
Right? You need to fight for the help. We'll help you. So it's kind of a bait and switch thing here on All Marine Radio. But one of the things that, you know, that you learn, that we all learn about your your journey and the guys who've gone through that is, one, there's a mental component, like what happens to me the rest of my life. Two, you've got these incredibly strong medications inside of you dealing with the physical pain, phantom pain, and all kinds of other things. So you have that going on. And now you've got to kind of sort out what becomes of me as well. That's no small cookie. Tell us about your time at Bethesda, and then, because ultimately that points you on the road to becoming a crazy marathon dude. So talk to us about that.
Well, you know, if you really, once I kind of had a chance to think about it, I think, well, you know, I didn't articulate this at the time, so this is all kind of, you know, post,
right,
kind of hindsight. So I think I realized at the time that just because I was an amputee didn't mean that the mission for my life had changed at all. And that the overall mission, you know, as bird's eye view as you can get. And so I still wanted to have a life that I could enjoy, and I still wanted to have a life that made a difference and made an impact and, you know, that I could be proud of. So, you know, that doesn't change just because I'm an amputee now or whatever happens. That's still kind of the objective for everyone's life, I think. And so once I realized that, it's just a matter of, you know, here's where I am, accepting where I am. You know, I'm an amputee. This is what I can do. This is what my situation is. And I still had the where I wanted to be, which is, you know, the enjoyable life, impactful life, etc. So realizing that the path that I was originally planning to take was now shut off, I just needed to find a new path. So it's like if I'm trying to drive to New York City from D.C. and I'm going along 95 and that gets cut off, well, I just have to take an exit and take another route. So I realized that, and so I just needed to start figuring out what that route was going to be, and the first part of that was to go into physical therapy and kind of learn to be self-sufficient and figure out what my body could do now, and kind of learn to use the implements that were going to help me to accomplish my mission.
The guys who've been on and talked about the camaraderie, the familiarity of the way the Marines that they encountered that were ahead of them in that process, and how they were Marines, and they were getting after a different task, and that environment helped them, and that attitude helped them. Talk about that. Did you encounter that? There wasn't a big pity party going on that most everybody was turning to in the same fashion? Talk about the environment.
Oh yeah, the environment's pretty much all important. And it's like you said. I mean, from the very beginning, I think I got, you know, they do visits from Walter Reed to Bethesda. So we were talking about guys that are working with prosthetics, going back and visiting people that had just gotten wounded and are still in the hospital bed. So they're going over there and they're telling them, you know, this is what you can expect, this is what you're going to be able to do, and just giving people a window into their future. And so you're kind of telling people what's going to be possible for them. And that is just a huge morale boost, because at that point in your life, you don't know what's going to be possible. You don't know what to expect. And now here comes some people with actual real life experience coming over, and they're showing you what they can do, and they're telling you that, you know, this is what life is like. And then when you get there, you're a little bit more prepared for it, and you're kind of, gets you a little bit excited, because, you know, you're actually seeing what's going to happen. And then, yeah, when you get there, it's just like a team effort among the prosthetist doctors, therapists, patients. When I first got there, I was able to look at what other double above knee amputees were doing in their therapy. And when I got to a point where I might have a little bit of trouble with something, you know, I could ask them the ways that they were figuring out how to do that. They could show me techniques, tricks, whatever have you. And they were showing me what was possible for me to accomplish. So the guy that I most remember doing this for me was Dan Knossen, who was a Navy SEAL, and he was a double above knee amputee. And he was probably a year or so ahead of me. And I would see him just walking around, no cane, no wheelchair, with a big backpack on his back, and just doing all sorts of working out in the clinic. And so I saw him, and I was like, well, okay, well, he's doing it, so it should definitely be possible for me. And kind of knowing what's possible for you makes it a lot easier to achieve that, because you can believe yourself. You can believe it's possible for yourself when you see somebody else do it. So, like climbing Mount Everest, you know, nobody knew it was possible until Hillary did it. And then, you know, now it's basically, you know, it's everybody thinks they can probably do it.
Yeah. Linville straight up did it. I said, how, Everest? He said, yeah. He said, well, I'm a bit of a plonk, and these guys who do this stuff for veterans suggested this mountain in Malaya. I looked at it and said, you know, it looks all right, but it doesn't look like that much of a challenge as I'm doing this. And they said, well, what do you want to do? And he said, how about Everest? And they said, well, we'll get back to you. He said they called a week later.
Yeah, no.
Called a week later and said, all right, you're on the list. Start training.
Yeah. Now that he's done that, he's proved that amputee can climb the mountain. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see more amputees doing it now. So he's just kind of breaking the barrier and setting the bar.
I want to ask you about that, Rob, because that to him, you know, so in talking to Linville, he said, I said, how did this get on your radar? And he said, I needed something to prove to myself, and he said, and to other people too, but primarily to myself, that I was capable of great things in my life. You sound like you had pretty much the same thing going on in your head.
Yeah, you know, you kind of, when you get wounded, it's easy to, you're no longer really sure what's possible for you, what you can do. You lose a little bit of self-confidence, maybe lose a little bit of self-reliance. And so it is important to go out there and find out what you can do. And so, you know, my kind of thing with that was the Paralympics. So I set my goal to make the Paralympics, and that was kind of my first real test of what I was capable of, and, you know, could I still push myself physically to my breaking point, and what could I accomplish with it? Could I still do stuff like this? Could I still have an impact in the world? Let's go find out. So I set that goal, and I did it, and, you know, I passed my first big test, and it's a really real big confidence booster. And, you know, you're never really going to know until you actually try. So, yeah, you can have all the doctors and therapists and prosthetists and whatever tell you, you know, you can or you can't, but they don't know because they're not you. And so you have to go out and actually try it and find out. And that's why you have so many people say that, you know, the doctors told me I would never walk again, but here I am running and doing all this stuff. And so that's a person that found out for themselves instead of just believing whatever they were told.
My guest this morning is, would you retire? What were you medically retired at? Sergeant?
Sergeant, yeah.
Sergeant Rob Jones, United States Marine Corps, former combat engineer. And you have probably heard about him because he ran 31 marathons in 31 days and made a bit of a national headline. And we're, as Marines, we're all said, yeah, no kidding, Marines do that. Are you kidding me? Like, doesn't everybody? No, so, I mean, I'll tell you, all of us take great pride, though, Rob, and, you know, when Linville went to the top of Mount Everest, first combat wounded person to summit Mount Everest, we were like, yeah, no shit, man. And he beat some Army guys by, like 2 weeks. And I asked him, I said, did you know that they were coming? He said, hell yeah, I knew they were going. I knew when they were going. And I was going to get there first. He said I was going to get there first. I've got an email question. What did you major in college?
I started as a computer science major, and then sometime in my junior year, I realized I was not studious enough at the time to make that happen, or just wasn't good enough at it. And so I ended up changing my major. I joined the Marine Corps and changed my major to interdisciplinary studies so I could just graduate from college and go fight in the war.
Interdisciplinary studies. One of my sons did that. He calls me and he says, hey, Dad.
Yeah, I don't.
I gave him my GI Bill. I gave him my GI Bill on that deal, right? And he said, hey, Dad, my GI Bill benefits are up. And I'd have to go another year and spend another 20 grand or I can get a degree in general studies and be done. I said, well, do you want my advice? Get out of there. Why are you going to pay another tour? Like, who cares what you majored in? Okay? Like, who cares? You have a degree from the University of Arizona, right? He said, yeah. I said, do you want to borrow 20 grand? He said, no. I said, there you have it though. So, why is Nielsen telling me you were an astronomy major?
So the way interdisciplinary studies work.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Is you have to have two minors. Yeah, so you do two minors and then you do a core curriculum for interdisciplinary studies. And so I forget exactly what it is, but you're basically taking two areas of study and kind of combining them. I picked my minors as astronomy and geology. And then I did the core curriculum, and that all of that adds up to the requirements to get a degree.
Wow.
Basically, just something I cobbled together so I could have a degree and then just go deploy as soon as possible.
There you go. Hey, Rob, I need to take a break, about a four-minute break. Will you hold on? And then I want to transition this thing to how you get pointed into marathon running and then and what you've done and what kind of experience that is. Do you mind? All right, my guest today, Rob Jones, Sergeant, United States Marine Corps, and if you look him up on the internet, you'll see all kinds of pictures of him. You'll see articles in the Washington Post and all kinds of other publications about him running. Some very, very cool pictures of him running on the mall, and great stuff. And we're privileged to have him on this morning with us. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here. On your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a group can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, BattleMug.com.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global SOF Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marine.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Age 16 on a Wednesday, and privileged to be joined by Rob Jones, Sergeant, United States Marine Corps, retired, and You've probably seen him on the news recently, and he's running marathons. And we've been talking to him about the story of how this all kind of happened and came together, his combat experiences, and then getting wounded. He's been gracious enough to share that all with us. So, Rob, talk to us about. I've got an email. Hey, Mac, what events did he run in the Paralympics? So there's one. There's one for you.
I just did. The only thing I actually did in the Paralympics was rowing.
Rowing.
I tried to make the Paralympics for triathlon in 2016, but I didn't make it.
Okay. All right. And so, talk to us about, you know, when you talk to guys about, you know, being an amputee, you know, the dividing line, if you will, is at the knee, right? Above or below the amputee knee, and then how high above the knee is the next question. Talk about, does where your amputations are impact the events that you can do, and or have we advanced relative to prosthetics that really doesn't matter anymore?
You know, it makes a difference. I think if I was below the knee, I probably would have been in a different category in my sport. Each sport has its own way of classifying and dividing up the disabilities. And so for rowing, I was trunk and arms only. And there was a legs, trunk and arms category as well. And so if I was below the knee on both, I probably would have been in that legs, trunk and arms category. So it's all just depending on the sport and how they decide to divide it up.
Now, had you ever rowed before in your life? Talk to us about, did you simply look and say, hey, what am I best suited for now? Or had you any experience in any of these endeavors?
I had rowed on the rowing machine as an able-bodied person. I'd never done it on the water. And it was kind of like what you said. I was researching sports that I could use to kind of test my new physical capabilities, and I heard about the Paralympics, and it turned out that rowing was in the Paralympics, and there was somewhere where I could learn how to row, and, you know, it just kind of worked out that I was pretty well suited for my category, and I had a partner that was looking for a partner herself, and, you know, a lot of things kind of fell into place with it.
All right. Let me, another question. Were you married when you were in Afghanistan? Were you attached to anybody? How did that part of your life work? Or were you single?
No, I was a single guy. You know, I had a couple ladies I was talking to, but
nice.
You know, nothing. Serious or, you know. What do you call it? Committed or anything like that? You know, just friends and everything.
Right.
I did end up being in a relationship pretty shortly after I got hurt with one of the gals I was talking to at the time. That didn't work out, but now I'm married to my wife, so you know, I think I'm pretty happy with how things turned out.
Nice. How'd you meet her?
We met at the 2012 Paralympics. She was rowing for Great Britain in that leg, trunk, and arms category I was telling you about.
Right.
And I was rowing for America in the trunk and arms category. So we didn't race against each other, but we met after the competition was over in a casino bar.
Nice. That means she's...
Yeah. We were ball partying kind of after the competition was over near the athletes' village.
Nice. What about if you guys rode head-to-head, who wins?
I guess it kind of depends. If we because, you know, obviously I can't use my legs to row, so she would beat me if we were just doing no rules. But if it was trunk and arms versus trunk and arms, I would win.
All right. That's good to know. Right. don't give that up. Talk to us about then. Okay, so you're a rower. So how does the whole marathon thing... how does the whole marathon thing happen? Where does that come from?
So I did rowing for that first year, 2011 to 2012, and then I did another season of rowing and went to World Championships in 2013. And then after that season ended, I had decided that I was going to ride my bicycle across the country. And so I did that between October of 2013 and April of 2014.
Okay,
in Maine.
Okay, hold on. So here's the question. Why did you do that?
Same exact reason I did the marathons. Trying to help prove that a wounded veteran is not a broken veteran. And trying to get the story out there about a veteran that had a traumatic experience in Afghanistan and was still able to find my new way to contribute to my country and to my community and stay in the fight. And so that was my way that I was going to do that. So I was raising kind of awareness for veterans and raising money for veteran charities. And my best way that I thought that I could do that personally was to ride my bicycle across the country, because when I was in the hospital, I was told that there was no other wounded veteran that had come through Walter Reed or any other hospital that was able to ride a bicycle, a regular bicycle, as a double above knee amputee. And so I figured I'd take that, learn how to ride a bicycle, which was pretty hard to do, and then take that and do something with it. And so that's why I decided to do it, ride my bike across the country during the winter time.
Okay, so go backwards. So you were told that there was no double above the knee amputee that had been able to do that.
There was only one other double above the knee amputee that I was aware of at the time that rode a normal bicycle and was able to, you know, mount and dismount by themselves. But he wasn't a veteran. He was a congenital birth defect.
Okay.
Resulted in his amputation. And so there was no other wounded veteran that had done it that was a double above knee amputee. And no other double above knee amputee has ridden a bicycle across the country. So I am the first and only to have done that. But, yeah, it was just me and one other guy that were even able to ride a bicycle.
Wow. Wow. So, why is it so difficult? I mean, if you don't mind getting into the mechanics, is it the prosthetic thing that makes it so difficult? What makes it so difficult?
It's a balance issue. Well, so the first part was figuring out how the prosthetic solution for being able to pedal, because all of us that were trying to, we weren't able to pedal forwards. We could only pedal backwards for some reason. And so we had to figure out a leg solution that would allow us to pedal forwards. And so a lot of that was kind of the onus on that was kind of with my prosthetist. And he would come up with different ideas. And then I would test them out and whether it would work or not. And then we'd go back and try something else. And then, so that took a long time. And then the getting to actually figuring out how to actually mount and dismount the bike, I wouldn't necessarily say it was incredibly difficult. It just took a lot of practice. You know, it's like when you're a kid, you don't learn it on your first try. And so figuring out the technique for doing it and then coming up with the prosthetic / equipment solution, like what clips should I use for the pedals, what kind of pedals should I use, and then kind of learning the technique and then actually practicing enough that I could do it by myself. So all that kind of stuff just took a lot of practice, and it wasn't the most difficult thing that anybody could ever do, but it wasn't easy either.
Wow. No, again, the things that we take for granted, right? That all of a sudden, listening to you talking about, well, I wanted to do this, we had to look at the engineering problems. And when you said that, I'm thinking about pedaling the bike. And you're talking about getting on the bike. You're talking about balance issues.
Yeah, it's everything.
It's everything. And so very much different than we would conceive. So what was it like riding a bike across the country? You know, this is the thing that's crazy, though, right, is that here you're a double above the knee amputee. You've done shit that none of us have done, right? Linville gone to the top of Mount Everest. I got two good legs. I don't know that I could do that. You know, Linville's done it. It's crazy the stuff that you guys do. And also the other crazy part of it is the what you overcome to do it. And you're talking about, what'd you call it? Hit your prosthetist? What did you call that guy?
prosthetist.
Okay, so that's your engineer, right?
Yeah, they're just people that make prosthetics.
Right.
So, you know, half engineer, half, artist, really.
Right. So you guys look at this problem and are looking for a solution to conquer this, and you get it done. So, yeah, so now, what was the coolest part about riding across the country?
It's just going to be all the people that supported me along the way. You know, I got so many free hotel rooms, meals, and receptions in every town I went through. And just pretty, really cool that people would hear about me and, you know, just kind of want to come out and support me. And my favorite part of the trip was actually riding through southern Utah, because we were in this 100-mile stretch of road where there was no towns. And it was, you know, I had been going through freezing cold weather for most of the trip, and then we got like a little warm spell, and it was in the 60s or 70s, and I was able to just kind of enjoy the scenery and ride with no cars and stuff, and camp out and stuff like that. So that was probably my favorite part of the whole ride.
What was the prettiest part of the whole ride?
Yeah, probably that same spot, because it was southern Utah, and
right.
You got the red rocks, and you don't have all those national parks down there. It's just really nice scenery.
Right. No, you know, at that part of the country, southern Utah, northern New Mexico, northern Arizona, that area in there is breathtaking. If you've never driven that part of the country, it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, it really is nice.
Where does the okay? So now you've done this, and the idea for the marathon. How does that? Let's run a marathon. Let's run a few. Where the hell does the idea 31 and marathons in 31 days come from? That's, you know, I don't physically, like, how the hell do you do that?
So like I was telling you before, I tried to make the Paramount Picture Triathlon, didn't make it. But with every failure, there comes a lesson. So one of the things I learned with that was that I had a pretty good talent for running, because I wasn't able to catch up to the people I was competing. I was competing against guys with one leg, single amputees, single above knee amputees, and I was never able to catch up to them on the swim or the bike because I was just so disadvantaged, not having the one quad muscle. So I was never able to catch up, but I would destroy everybody on the run times. Because I had a little bit of an advantage over them, but I realized that, you know, I was able to run 5K in 18 minutes, which is kind of the standard for the Marine Corps PFD, is even faster than that. So,
holy shit!
So I was able to do that, and so I realized I had some talent for running, and I, on a whim in 2015, I just decided to run the Marine Corps Marathon because it seemed like a pretty good challenge, and I ran it in 4 hours and 12 minutes. So I realized, you know, I had a decent ability in the, you know, average ability in the marathon distance as well. And, you know, after I failed to make the Paralympics, so I was just looking for another challenge. And, I know that there was people that have done similar formats where, you know, Iron Cowboy did 50 Ironmans in 50 states in 50 days. There's been a guy that's done 50 marathons in 50 states, 50 days. And so I just kind of took that format and I put my own little spin on it. And what I wanted to do was get it in front of as many eyeballs as possible and try and keep the public interest for the optimal amount of time. So I picked a full month of marathons, and, you know, I picked the longest month, which was 31 days. And I was trying to come up with different numbers that I could use. So the obvious number would be that, you know, the 20 or 22, whatever you subscribe to, and then, but I figured that would be kind of short. It would be too short, because once I got going, it would be over. And then I thought, well, 50 is a big number, so maybe I'll do 50, and then, but I realized, I figured that might be a little bit too long, because people might start to lose interest. They say, oh, that guy's still doing it. And so, I figured, you know, people could probably pay attention for a full month. And maybe that'd probably be a good length of time, so I just decided one entire month of marathons.
All right, here's an email question for you. Mac, I read about this, and I remember seeing a report on television my question is, a lot of times, just the fittings themselves for prosthetics are not the most comfortable, and it takes a while for the body to get used to them. But that kind of wear and tear on your body over the course of a month has got to be incredible. How did he do that? Yeah, you know, we've heard from guys who, God, who was it that was on, talked about, and he talked about, actually, you know, it's, you know, one of the cool things about this radio program and the audience of Marines that listen to it is that it's our tribe, right? We get it. You know, he was talking about, he said, you know, look, he said the powerful medications that you have, you know, what it does to your ability to have sex. And then you get different prosthetics and they, your body operates different. And then you go through these, you know, alignment issues, where it's not like just putting on another pair of shoes. You wish it was like that, but it's not like that. And then you also have issues relative to your stumps adapting to, you know, how they're strapped in and things like that. So along those veins, how does your body take that kind of wear and tear over the course of a month? That's 812.2 miles.
Yeah, you have to, definitely have to get the prosthetics as comfortable as possible. That's, you know, job number one, because if you're in pain wherever you walk, then you're not going to be able to do anything. So I spent the time before I started getting my prosthetics as comfortable as I could, making sure, you know, they're, you know, just about as snugly fitting as possible. Mm-hmm. You're never going to get it perfect, but you can get it as good as possible. And then I kind of had to learn the hard way, about where the spots on my legs were that were going to chafe the skin. So I would do long runs and I would look at them afterwards and I would see that, all right, well, this spot, I took the skin off here, here, and here. So on future runs, I would lubricate those spots with chamois cream and I would see if it did it again. And if it didn't, then I would just keep lubricating that spot every time. And so, really, it was just about prevention of breaking down as opposed to recovering from breaking down. So I would kind of did my research beforehand before I started and learned where I was going to need to prevent breakdown. And then I ran all the marathons at a pace that would prevent my body from breakdown. So I kept my heart rate under all, totally aerobic, so I kept it under 150 beats per minute. I paced it so that my body wouldn't produce a bunch of byproducts that I would have to recover from.
Right.
And so it was all just about prevention.
You sound a bit scientific there, big man. You sound like, you know, your approach, honestly, your approach to simply your injuries was more analytic and less emotional than a lot of guys I've spoken with. And even your discussion now of, you know, of doing this is very analytical about byproducts that your body's going to produce and keeping this and keeping that, is much more analytical. Is that you?
Yeah, well, you know, I had the, 4 or 5 years of, athletic background, so I knew a lot of this stuff.
Right.
And yeah, you have to put a lot of thought into it. It's not something that you can really do just off the couch and then just kind of go out and run. You have to research it and you have to prepare yourself as much as you can. And in terms of the emotional stuff, you know, there's times where it's okay to be emotional, but I don't really think being emotional about stuff is really going to actually advance your cause. So you have to really sit there and detach yourself from the emotions and think about it. And so that, you know, that's usually what I'm able to do pretty quickly.
All right. Here's a few emails for you. Mac, first of all, how do we follow Rob? I want to congratulate him on his journey so far. It sounds like he has other great things in front of him, though, and it won't be certainly the last time we hear from him. I, too, like others, saw the story and was certainly proud when I saw that it was a Marine doing this. How do we follow him?
Best way, robjonesjourney.com is my website. And all my social media is at Rob Jones Journey.
Okay.
That's the easiest thing. I have Instagram, Facebook, Twitter.
All right, all that. So Rob Jones' journey, and he's got a big map, shows everywhere he went. And
Exactly. Making it easy for all these Marines, keeping it all the same.
Taking and you even ran in London.
Yeah, I ran in London because we're not in these wars to get alone. We have allies. I've worked with British forces before,
right?
And I wanted to, you know, they're facing the same issues as us, you know, and so I wanted to do my part for them as well, you know, because if we, you know, work on it all together, we're all brothers as far as I'm concerned. So I wanted to link them in on it too. And so I, you know, it added an extra layer to the difficulty as well.
Right, right. Nice. The, another email. Mac, I heard him say that his wife is from the UK. Is the Invictus game something that he's participated in?
I never have, but that's only because the timing's never worked out.
Okay.
I've always had other things that I was working on that I kind of wanted to, you know, like training for the Paralympics or training for my marathon challenge or whatever.
Right.
But I do plan on participating in them next year.
The he seems like, Prince Harry seems like a cool guy. I don't know shit about him. He was in Afghanistan where we were flying helicopters at that time.
Yeah, I never met him.
Yeah, but he seems like...
He's pretty cool, though.
Yeah,
as far as princes go.
As far as all the princes I know about, he seems like right up there in terms of cool factor.
Seems like a pretty down-to-earth person for a prince.
Well, you know what? I think one of the things he's done is he's talked about like the death of his mother. And how that jacked him up. And he said, hey, I just walled it off, man. I didn't want to go there. And people want to tell me I need to talk about it. Like, yeah, right. I don't want to talk about that. You know, I lost my mom in a very public way when I was a little kid. Come on. And I think it's very cool that he's kind of shown that side of himself. But I think by far the coolest thing he's done is the Invictus Games. And you see him there and I think it's cool because people get to see us among each other. And for instance, like, I'll see somebody, a younger guy or girl with a prosthetic device, and I'll walk up to him and I'll say, hey, where'd you get that? And they'll say, Afghanistan. And I'll say, what year? And you know, lo and behold, you were there, you know, close to when they were there, and you start off this conversation. How you doing? What are you doing now? And then I remember at first I'd walk away and my kids would look at me and like, Dad, you can't say that. I said, the hell I can't. That's our tribe. We don't care. We don't care.
Yeah.
That means nothing to us.
Yeah.
It's normal. Traumatic brain injuries, amputations, he's us. And I took, you know, it's always interesting to take your kids. I have a 14-year-old daughter, but I took her down to the Wounded Warrior Games at Pendleton. And she, you know, you can imagine a 14-year-old seeing, you know, guys in wheelchairs playing basketball that range from guys who have both their legs to guys who have, you know, high double amputations. And she's sitting there watching it. And then she's saying,
yeah.
Why does that guy have a glove on? Well, I don't think he has a hand. And that's how he does it. Oh, okay. Why is that guy's leg crooked? Because he's got a prosthetic device under that pant leg. Oh, okay. And then, you know, you have these great conversations with your kids, and like, Dad, they seem so happy though. I said, they're among each other. This is our tribe. This is where, you know, it's natural for us. And, you know, it's all good. Here's another email. Mac, 31 marathons in 31 days. I find that physically hard to believe. What was the hardest thing physically about doing that, even given the fact that he kept his RPMs at something relatively controllable? That is a lot. 812.2 miles? That's a lot of miles, man. I don't know about you because you're a smart guy, but to me, that's a lot of miles.
I guess it depends on what you're comparing it to.
Exactly.
I think it was just the fact that I had to do it every single day, the same exact thing, over and over and over and over. Was probably the toughest thing. The most difficult thing physically was definitely, you know, dealing with that soreness every single day. Same spots would hurt, and there was really not much I could really do about it besides just wait for it to kind of numb up a little bit every day. So
really? There
was definitely spots.
Was there any point during the 812 miles in 31 days that you said, I don't know if I can go today?
No. There wasn't any point like that. there were definitely days where I was thinking, today's going to hurt because I was a sore or whatever. But no, I never had any doubt. I knew I never had any doubt that I would be able to do it unless some kind of freak accident happened, like if I broke a bone or something.
Right.
You know, I knew that anything could happen at any point, so I was never absolutely 100% positive that I could, that I was going to finish, but I knew that if nothing, you know, went wrong, I'd be able to.
Got it. Another email. Mac, what an awesome interview this morning. You know, I got up this morning having my own personal pity party, and then in parentheses, I'm not going to tell you what it was because I know you'll ridicule me for it. But nonetheless, I was having my own personal pity party. I've been listening now for over an hour, and I just want to say congratulations to Rob. What an inspiration. I, like others, saw his story. And even listening to it today, his positive attitude throughout this whole thing, I find absolutely amazing. Congratulations to him. Congratulations to him on his marriage and nothing but continued success in Semper Fidelis.
Well, you know, that makes me happy. That's what I'm trying to do. Trying to get my story out there for people to use when they're having those times that have a little bit of difficulty. And you know, I can't receive a greater compliment than to be endorsed like that by a fellow Marine, fellow veteran. That's as good as it gets as far as I'm concerned in terms of, you know, endorsements or compliments. So thanks.
You know, and one of the things, you know, Rob, it's like, you know, whether we're talking about somebody struggling with mental health issues or whether they're struggling with physical issues and getting their medications balanced, whatever it is, you know, you're another great example of somebody who's, you know, who's fought through it. And let me read you another question here. Mac, as he looks back now, what's been the most difficult part of his journey since that day in Afghanistan when he functioned that IED? And a second question, if I might, where is he going in the future? So, interesting question. Most difficult part since you functioned that IED was what?
I don't know that I can really select one superlative like that. I don't think it probably hasn't been as difficult as a lot of people might think it would be.
Shut up, man. I can't believe you just said that. Double amputee above the knee. I don't think it's been as difficult as some people might imagine. Are you shitting me, man? Come on.
I think it's important to downplay things a little bit.
A little bit, I guess.
Perspective a little bit. I'm a double amputee. There's plenty of quadruple amputees out there, so it's kind of, you know, you just have to keep it in perspective.
Can I pay you a compliment on that?
Sure.
Well, no, and what you just said is an important lesson. And you know, my oldest sister lost both of her sons. She had two, ages 4 years old and 6 years old. When her husband at the time, after she told him she was leaving, shot him both in the head and then put the gun in his mouth and killed himself. And I tell guys who think they have it tough, hey, look, if my older sister can do it, you can do it. Okay? And of all the horrible things that we've seen, you haven't seen your kid get killed here, have you? I mean, good friends maybe, but not your kids. You can do it. Because there's always somebody that has it worse than you. So, no, man, I think that is a great lesson. I'm busting your balls for it, but it's an awesome lesson that my family knows and lives all the time.
Yeah, and at the same time, it's just important to approach something like it is normal. So if I sat there in my hospital bed and I said, being an amputee is the most difficult thing that anybody could ever do. It is such a bad thing, and it is such a tragedy, blah, 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 and go on like that, then I'm going to manifest it that way. And so if I sit there and I go, all right, being a double amputee is not exactly what I had envisioned, but it's not that big of a deal, then it's going to become normal for me, and it keeps it in perspective. So if something is normal, it's a lot easier to handle. Does that make sense?
Well, it absolutely makes sense, and I want to flip it also to the area of post-combat related mental health. Look, everybody, mm-hmm. all the Marines listening with post-traumatic stress, and the people that will listen to this with post-traumatic stress, nobody gave that to you, man. You earned it in combat for your country. You're part of a select group of warriors on this planet, and when you become part of that tribe, guess what goes along with it? Oh, what's this token for? Oh, that's your post-traumatic stress token, man. You're never going to get rid of it. And so to me, if you look at it as this is a normal part of this experience, these other guys have dealt with it. Many guys have grown from it. I need to follow their example, and I need to try to grow from it. I need to learn to live with it because it's going to be a normal part of my life. And I think your advice is extremely insightful, and you might want to look into becoming a public speaker.
That's what I'm doing.
All right, that leads me into the next email nicely. Hey, Mac, how do we book Rob to be a speaker? Is there a way we can do that through his website?
Yes, go on my website. There's a button right on the front there. Just click it. It says something like book Rob to speak or something like that, but it's on the
front
page.
That's the easy button.
Yeah.
The
So that's what I'm doing, and trying to keep spreading my message that way, and hopefully, keep having a good effect on people.
Okay, what is the message?
My message?
Yeah.
I guess I have very many, but a couple of them are, broken veteran or wounded veterans, not a broken veteran. I'm trying to get that out there to the veteran population as well as the civilian population, because I don't know if you've seen all the latest movies that came out, but pretty much every one of them this year has the same exact storyline. Veteran goes overseas, has a traumatic experience, comes back and implodes, destroys their family, and can't handle life as a civilian. And I'm trying to get it out there that actually we can. And I want veterans to see that, and I want civilians to see that, so they have a better understanding of what it's like to be a veteran. And the other main one I would say would be to figure out a way to use your tragedies as a tool to make yourself stronger and more capable. So I use my amputation as a way to become more capable of help fighting for my fellow veterans on the home front. And so I just have to remain, accept your situation and kind of try and have the imagination and the forethought that figuring out the way that this tragedy could possibly be used to make yourself stronger.
All right. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you that you want people to know?
I think you've been smart enough. I think you've covered everything that I usually ever cover and even have to say. I've said about everything that I can possibly think of.
Okay, that was just so you know, that was a trick question. You answered it right, though, just so you know.
You're a genius, is what I'm saying.
No, that's the general article, man. It's like, look, there's probably something that he has to say that I haven't been smart enough to ask him, but let me throw it out there. First of all, Rob, thanks for taking time and doing this. We get close to 700,000 hits a year on the work that we do here, and a lot of it is the same message, is that you can do it. Don't quit. you know, the same qualities that are held in high regard in the Marine Corps, whether it's in peacetime and combat, which are improvise, adapt, and overcome. Now that if you're out of the Marine Corps dealing with mental health or physical issues, just continue to do that. Don't quit. Don't kill yourself. Don't make us go to another funeral. You're part of our tribe. We'll always be there for you. All you got to do is pick up the phone. And so, first of all, congratulations for spreading that message of hope, of vitality, in spite of, you know, the fact that you've been physically impacted, by the war. And I hope you don't mind in the future if I call you and bug you to come back on again when we talk about different issues relative to either physical or mental health. And thanks for doing this.
Yeah, man, anytime. I appreciate you guys letting me come on and, you know, help keep and spread my message. So I appreciate it.
All right. How did you meet Bob?
Looking forward to coming back.
How did you meet Bob Nielsen? And do you think he's a nice guy?
Bob Nielsen?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if I have been. Have I met him?
Yeah, he's the guy that introduced us.
I think he might have emailed my wife.
Oh, okay. I thought you had met him because he was all over me. Hey, you got to meet this guy.
I might have, but he's with Turner Construction.
Right.
No, yeah. So he was in the. Yeah, no, no. He was in. He was always in the physical therapy clinic. Yeah, so that's how I met him. Yeah.
So that you met him.
I thought it was Bob Nielsen.
Nielsen. No.
That's how you pronounce it.
No. Nielsson. Weird.
Yeah.
Weird spelling.
Nielsen. So yeah, he was in the physical therapy clinic.
Where? Walter Reed or Bethesda?
Walter Reed.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. First of all, have a great day. Thanks for taking. All the time this morning and doing this and good luck in what's your next adventure?
I do not know yet. I'm going to have to say TBD on that one.
All right. So give them the website one more time.
RobJonesJourney.com. Social media is at RobJonesJourney.
All right. So RobJonesJourney, if you click on that and if you scroll down, you can sign up for updates. So.
Yep.
All Marine Radio just did, so we will report on whenever whatever Rob has for dinner, you'll know about it. So, Rob.
Awesome.
All right, man. Thanks for the visit.
Talk to you guys later.
All right. See ya. That is Rob Jones here on All Marine Radio. Sergeant, United States Marine Corps, medically retired, double amputee, doing great things. It's the coolest part of this job. Coolest part of this job is meeting guys like that. And wow. All right. More of All Marine Radio. We're going to talk jobs coming up next. Retired Marine Corps Master Sergeant Ernest Cardenas. He is he's going to join us next. And he's now, just a quick tease of what we're going to talk about. Cardenas is getting out, and he doesn't know what he's going to do. And every day he's coming into work, and he's like, oh, you know, what do? I'm working this guy, and I'm working this, and blah, 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 and... sir, what do you think, you know? And so I'd give him my opinion. He's talking to me about people he knows, former grunts. They're in this business, they're in that. What do you do? You know, and then jobs, you know, got to travel all the time. I'm like, you've been away too long, man. You don't want to do that. But everybody, you know, when they get out, you know, everybody's nervous. Like, I need a job. I got, you know, come on. You know, my wife, she's on me. You got to work, man. So, he's got a good family, but, so he became, a UAS instructor, and he's a leader. And so now he's a big time guy there, and he's looking for people that are looking for jobs. So if you're looking for a job, you don't want to miss this next segment. So, retired Marine Corps Master Sergeant Ernest Cardenas. And, yeah, so if you're looking for work or if you maybe want to change jobs, we're going to talk about what he does and what they're looking for as that supports the Marine Corps. And they're looking for people to become instructors. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on a Wednesday edition Hump Day right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.